You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas. This past week, we Americans got to see our government worship a war criminal. Bibi Netanyahu addressed Congress, and Congress, for the most part, embraced, applauded, and even groveled at the feet of this man. A man who could travel anywhere else in the world and definitely be arrested. This criminal would not be arrested in America. He would be adored publicly by our very own U.S. government. Fortunately, the American government is not the American people. And the complete and utter violation of American ideals did not go unnoticed by the people. Thousands went to D.C. to protest the address of Netanyahu and our government's apparent abandonment of any standards, be they constitutional, legal, or even ethical. And neither Bibi nor Congress had any standards of truth of any kind. The speech itself didn't sound like that of a statesman. It sounded more like something a drunk uncle would say if asked to do a speech about the current situation after Thanksgiving dinner. The lies were so outrageous it was comical. And our Congress stood and applauded Bibi's lies repeatedly. But the persistence of lies in the telling of what happened October 7th is certainly not comical. The cognitive dissonance between well-researched facts and the fantasies the ruling elite continued to tell themselves about Palestinians is truly stunning. The original fairy tales that emerged from October 7th made an appearance in Bibi's speech. He spoke of Hamas raping women, beheading men, burning babies alive, and weren't those babies in an attic? I don't know. There was something about an attic. I lost track of the details at a certain point. If it's weird to hear an American white woman being flippant about such things, you should know that I'm a child of the satanic panic in the United States. I grew up with adults telling much more gruesome tales of sexual assault and child abuse that were absolutely false. I know the kind of over-the-top story that goes with the moral panic when I hear it. Despite multiple articles and much time, we have yet to see any actual proof of crimes beyond killing and hostage-taking. We have no eyewitnesses or victim testimony of beheadings, burning of bodies, sexual assault, torture. And wasn't there a baking of a child in an oven? Again, completely unsourced. Even more telling is how the details of unsourced stories change depending on who is telling them and when. It's important to believe victims, but when you have these stories of terrible crimes and no victim, it's time to ask some questions. This past week, the person who put his finger on this exact issue in the current environment is Arun Gupta. Arun is a freelance investigative journalist, and he did a deep dive into the rape accusations surrounding October 7th for the Middle East Monitor. The title of his piece is, "Israel Has Manufactured an Industrial-Scale Version of Jim Crow Rape Hoaxes." He spoke about his research in the Middle East Monitor show entitled Conversations with Nassim Ahmed. For today's show, I wanted to share most of this interview. We have a lot to listen to, so yalla bina, let's go.
So tell us a bit about your motivations for wanting to write this piece, and how long have you been working on it?
Well, I've been working on it really since October 7th. I noticed within 24 hours that there were already allegations of rape that were being made by Israeli media sources. I believe it was a Times of Israel report that first came out within hours after the October 7th attacks. And it was a story I was paying attention to, because when you do investigative reporting, you start to really develop a good eye and ear for fabrications, for lies, for fabulism. And so I was noticing very early on that there were certain clues, which is that the stories were outlandish, and at the same time, there was also no evidence whatsoever. And so that's in the first few weeks of October 2023. And as the story started to develop, what you would see in the media, and here I'm referring to Israeli media and Western media, US and UK especially, there started to be excuses for why there was no evidence. And this goes against everything every journalist is ever taught, right? You know, your only job is to find and verify evidence, really, to put together a story. Instead, what we started to get was all these excuses, especially invoking religion, that because of Jewish burial law, this is a reason there was no forensic evidence, that the bodies had to be buried quickly, that there wasn't time for forensics, that the rescuers who were making claims of women being raped, about sexual mutilation, about bizarre things being done to bodies, body parts being cut off. They're making claims that they saw all these things, but there's no photographic or video evidence. So very early on, I started to suspect that this is just a giant hoax. And by early December, I started to approach publications. And generally, I write for more kind of left of center media, because that's it's it mainly because I've had much more success with the type of stories that I want to write about. And certainly, if you want to write anything critical of Israel, you're not going to go to right wing media, and you're not going to go to mainstream media itself. But I also had another motivation, which is I have been in complete solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for liberation since the First Intifada began in 1987. And I was much younger than I am today. I was a kid. I really avoid trying to use terms like pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli. To me, this is about the basic right for self-determination and national liberation. Israel is just another colonizing force. And frankly, you know, anyone in the world, you know, I think in the Western world would agree today, or nearly anyone, that the conquest of native indigenous peoples was appalling and horrific. What Israel is doing to Palestine is clearly, it is just the latest in that chapter of trying to exterminate natives to take over and colonize their land.
On your ability to publish, and how much of a setback has there been? What kind of publications have rejected you, refused you? I mean, how much of a challenge has it been for you to actually tell that story?
Oh, it has been absolutely an extraordinary challenge. And you know, I'll say, when it comes to the mainstream media, I've quite a jaundiced eye, and I've been freelancing for left of center media for over 20 years. And maybe, you know, it's my own naivete, but it's just been appalling the response that I have gotten when I've pitched these articles. And I don't want to burn all my bridges here, but I will name some publications. A journalist friend helped me contact Al Jazeera English editors, and they swiftly rejected the article. And I was shocked by that. And they said, we have something in the works. And yet, to my knowledge, I've yet to see anything on their website debunking the Israeli rape narratives. Maybe they eventually publish something, but I approached them, I believe, in early January. I had another example is Plus 972 magazine. I had a 40-minute video discussion with two editors there, and the moment one of them opened their mouths, I knew they were never going to accept my article. And it was because the editor, who described herself as a Palestinian and a feminist, said, it's unlikely, we don't know how many rapes happened on October 7th. It's unlikely it was 50 or 100, but we don't know if it was 1 or 5 or 10 or 20. And I was just like, my eyes were rolling like a slot machine, because I'm just like, you are basically doing the dirty work of Hasbara. It is not the job of journalists to speculate how many rapes happened on October 7th. Now, at this point, I will say, I will debate anyone in the world that, including any Israeli intelligence official who has access to all the secret information, and I will say there is zero evidence of sexual violence on October 7th itself. But journalists should not be speculating. The approach I've taken and the proper approach to take is to say, look, all these claims have been made. Let's look at the claims one by one and hold them up to scrutiny. And when you start to do that, you start to see they all fall apart. The most infamous example of this is the New York Times article, Screams Without Words, that was published December 28th. I actually, hours later, I pitched The Intercept on a story. They accepted the pitch. I delivered a 5,000-word report debunking Screams Without Words. This was a story that was eventually published by Yes Magazine, much to their credit. And for anyone who's followed the story, they know that all the cases in Screams Without Words have now been debunked. The Unit 669 paramedic who claimed he saw the corpses of two girls who were raped, all the various volunteers from Zaka, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish organization that collects human remains after mass casualty attacks, they have all been outed as fabulous, as liars, as basically creating all this atrocity propaganda in what really looks like a deal with the government. In exchange, they were bankrupt on October 7th, and in exchange for atrocity propaganda, they turned October 7th into a giant cash grab. When you look at the accounts, the two people who claim they actually saw rape, Witness S. or Sapir and Roz Cohen, their stories have completely fallen apart. The New York Times lead story of Gal Abdush, this woman whose half-naked corpse was found, that story has completely fallen apart. So when I sent this article to The Intercept, basically senior editors killed it. But there was another editor there, the one who commissioned it, who wanted to use it. And to make a long story short, he ended up using significant chunks of my reporting in The Intercept's article about Anat Schwartz. I'm at this point, I'm just going public with it because the evidence is all there. You can compare the article I sent them to the article they publish about Anat Schwartz. I had nothing to do with the stuff about Anat Schwartz, who was one of the New York Times reporters on Screams Without Words. But if you look at all the examples they give debunking them, that was from my original report. So this is really one of the most, and there are many other publications, left-leaning publications I approached. I'll mention The Guardian as another one. They didn't respond, even though I know one of the senior editors, and they've published rape atrocity propaganda. But many of the biggest left publications in the U.S. would not touch this story, and I twisted the arms of some editors who admitted to me it was because they were afraid of being called rape denialists.
So why do you think many of these outlets, news outlets, those who are supporters of the Palestinian issue, very critical of Israel as well, they've basically accepted parts of the Israeli narrative? I mean, generally, as you mentioned, you'd seek evidence for something like this, and Israelis have made no qualms about the fact that Palestinians went into Hamas fighters went into Israel and they live streamed their atrocities. If that's the case, then where people one would automatically assume it. So where is the video footage? If they live streamed all their crimes, where's the footage of these allegations? So but there's an assumption there now, the Israelis in this case are correct, and we have to basically find the evidence to fit the narrative. But it should be the other way around. But we expect many of the pro-Israeli and the right-wing press to try and fit their evidence to their narrative. But many of the others have done that as well. Why is that? Why have they been so reluctant to challenge this and ask them basic questions?
I think it's a combination of, there's this a British feminist scholar Sophie Lewis, who I've come across because of my research and writing on this, who uses the term femo-nationalism and Zionist feminism. Zionist feminism. So basically what she's arguing is that there are these types of white colonial feminism. And I think, frankly, when you look at a lot of the publications, and, you know, there's not a lot of prominent left publications. An astute individual can figure out some of the ones I'm talking about. I think the editorial leadership tends to be very white, and even if it's not completely white, it's very white thinking. You know, this is one of the reasons I think Yes Magazine was open to publishing this piece, because its senior editorial leadership is women of color. And they also, you know, get things like, you know, Jim Crow rape hoaxes. So they understand this happens. And so I think it is this kind of like white feminism is at operation here that intersects with Orientalism. So one of the senior editors at The Intercept, Galab Dush, you know, she was has been termed the woman in the black dress. Her and her husband Nagi were killed really in the first minutes after the October 7th attack. They were at the Supernova Music Festival and they had fled in the car. And basically, the Times story fell apart because the Times spent a good bit of time with the surviving family, like parents, sisters, the children of the couple, Gal and Nagi, and they had access to all the text messages and audio messages. And the Times, in what is incredibly dishonest, they only relayed a few of the messages, and they did not relay the fact that at 6:51 a.m., Gala Abdush sent in a text message to her family that there were intense explosions at the border and they were fleeing. 9 minutes later, her husband, Nagi Abdush, sent a voicemail to his brother, and I interviewed his brother, the voicemail saying that Gal has been shot in the heart and she's dying. And so the Times story completely fell apart, because we're to believe somehow that in this 9 minute period where they're fleeing in a car, that somehow the car is stopped, they're attacked, they're captured, Gal and Nagi Abdush, they are taken hostage, Gal is sexually assaulted, then she is killed. Meanwhile, her husband Nagi is free to communicate with his relatives, and he never mentions anything about being captured or that his wife is being raped, or the story is entirely fabricated. And the Times admits that they had no evidence to go on other than a grainy video of her corpse. And so I included this debunking in my piece for The Intercept, and one of the senior editors, a woman, said, like, she wrote in the notes, which I still have, she said, well, the fact that her dress was up, you know, we can't rule out the fact that she wasn't sexually assaulted afterwards. And I just threw my hands up in the air because I'm like, yes, of course, because, you know, these Palestinians are such savages. They can't help themselves around even the dead body of a naked white woman, and they have to sexually assault it. I mean, and so I think, like, there's still a lot of Orientalism that infects even left media in the United States. And they buy into this believe all women. You know, and that's why I go back to Jim Crow rape hoaxes, right? Because you look at, you know, the worst massacre of all, Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1921, I believe it was, that started with allegations of a black man sexually assaulting a white female elevator operator. And 300 African Americans were killed in it, and it involved both the Oklahoma National Guard and the U.S. Army Air Force bombed Black Wall Street. The destruction of Rosewood, Florida in 1923 was a rape hoax. There was a pogrom in Atlanta that was a rape hoax. The Scottsboro Boys were a rape hoax. Emmett Till was a false sexual harassment assault accusation, on and on and on. And what I say, what the real story is, you know, and to put it very bluntly, it's this colonial narrative in which that basically states that the savage hordes of darkies are threatening the purity of white women. Therefore, we must exterminate the savage hordes of darkies. And this goes back to colonial America. We're talking over 300 years, right? You know, with Native Americans and what was known as captivity narratives. People can read the article where I detail it, but this was also a prominent feature of slave society in which, you know, there was this constant fear of slave rebellions and uprisings in which white women were going to be raped by these slaves. Then during the Jim Crow era, there was called the brute caricature of the, you know, animalistic, predatory black male, and on, and it continues through American empire. You know, Orientalism, you know, Edward Said's masterpiece in which, you know, the West constructs the East as savage and barbaric, and up to the present day. And I'm saying, what, Israel is using the exact same playbook, because not only are they fabricating these claims, and there is only one credible case, but it was a Israeli woman who was held in captivity for over a month, right? That's completely different. She was sexually assaulted amidst Susana. She was sexually assaulted in Gaza. And if you read her story, it's completely believable. But that did not happen on October 7th. Meanwhile, what these this kind of narratives do is they completely invert the sexual violence, because of course it's the colonizer is the one who's carrying out the sexual violence, right? By the right of basically the church and king, conquistadors could rape native women, and they did en masse. Slavery, chattel slavery, was built on the rape of black women for the slave master's pleasure, sadism, and to create new slaves, new property, right? During the Jim Crow era, rape was an instrument, one of the main instruments of racial terror. That's what Jim Crow was, a regime of racial terror. And so what we see going up to this day, you know, and the U.S. bought sexual violence and sexual trafficking wherever it went abroad, Japan, Korea, the Philippines, Vietnam. I mentioned even modern day Iraq, in Afghanistan. You know, there's a huge number of girls who were being sold because the families were so impoverished. And what are they being sold for? Almost certainly sexual trafficking. And so Israel has actually been carrying out all this gender-based violence and all this sexual violence against Palestinians, both men and women, boys and girls. And in fact, they flaunt a lot of it. All these pictures of semi-naked or even fully naked Palestinian men being humiliated and degraded. And the United Nations has been trying to bring attention to this. So what Israel has been doing is they've been using the rape hoaxes to actually try to silence UN women's organizations that are trying to bring attention to actual sexual violence that Israel is carrying out. And so it's a complete inversion of reality. And I think at this point, people's minds have been so infested by the Hasbara that even on the left, I find often run into people who find it hard to believe that there was no sexual violence occurred on October 7th. The most effective instrument I've had is to liken it to, like, look, this is a modern day Jim Crow rape hoax, except it's on an industrial scale where Israel is using these allegations of rape to exterminate 2 million Palestinians. You know, and that's a separate issue. But I think at this point, even talking about the death tolls is irrelevant. Whatever Israel is completely physically, psychologically devastating Gazan society. And, you know, it's who knows what's going to remain if this war ever ends. And even as recently as a month ago, Israel was bringing up claims before the International Criminal Court of that hostages were being threatened with sexual violence, which is why they needed to continue the war, which is, of course, completely absurd because Hamas has been willing to release all the hostages as long as there is a guaranteed end to the war.
I mean, there is a long tradition, as you highlight, of well-worn racist tropes about black and brown people raping white women. That's been used over and over again throughout history, and you point that out. And on the issue of Israel raping Palestinians, the latest is what the horrific stories coming out of the Israeli detention center, Setaimen, I think it's called. Even CNN, New York Times, a number of other Western mainstream newspapers have published articles exposing the rape that's been taking place in these detention centers. So it's quite horrific, and it corresponds with a lot of what you're saying. I want to turn now to your article itself specifically and talk a little bit about the source of the mass rape allegations. You speak a lot about that. Who are the key actors, and what is the main source of the rape allegations that has been disseminated and accepted as gospel by many outlets?
So here's what's really interesting. If you go back and you dissect the story from the beginning, and I recount this part in the Yes Magazine article, is in the first days and 2 weeks after October 7th, the Israeli state was actually doing media tours of its two main forensic facilities. There's a National Forensic Institute, and then the Shura military base, which is where most corpses went, and where also a lot of the most absurd atrocity propaganda was emanating from. And they were initially making claims, and there you were having military officials as well as some medical personnel were making claims that there was rape. They had evidence of rape. But then suddenly they all went silent. And then a couple of weeks later, starting really like about 2 weeks after October 7th, you start to have these civilians coming forward who are making these outlandish stories. Sherry Mendez is one of them. She's a volunteer IDF reservist at the Shura military base. And she started going before the media, talking on camera about just the horrific things had been seen. And she's someone who comes across as very kind of like motherly. She's around 60 years old. She's an architect from New Jersey. Of course, you know, 10% of Israeli Jews are from the United States. And so she is making these allegations about how, you know, she says things like, yes, we saw rape from children to grandmothers. And she says they were there was so much gang rape, it broke their pelvises. And that right there, again, as an investigative reporter, I'm like, just stop right there. First of all, no one has made any other claims that children were raped. So that is a completely new claim. And no one in the 8 months since she said that has claimed that children were raped. Secondly, to claim that the rape was breaking pelvises, it's just like, this is one of the strongest bones in the human body. You know, again, and, you know, there's a saying, you know, in journalism that extraordinary, and also science, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And there was zero evidence. And yet this is someone who's speaking at one of the main forensic sites where she's making these claims. Then she just says all sorts of other stuff about body parts chopped off, about genital mutilations, about beheaded children. And again, we know that's completely, or beheaded babies, we know that's completely false because the number of infants killed was one and she was shot. And in fact, there's a photo of her on one of these Israeli government websites that I mentioned. But then she also starts telling the story about a pregnant mother who was butchered and her fetus was removed and the fetus was killed and then the mother was shot. And so what I started to do was start to follow all these people who are making claims. And what I eventually I discovered was there's really only 12 sources, right? There's a vast number of stories, thousands and thousands of stories that have been written, probably tens of thousands, claiming there was rape on October 7th. But there's only 12 sources who account for the vast majority of these claims. There's a bunch of minor sources, maybe a couple of dozen, but they account for very few claims that you see in the media. Of these dozen sources, three of them came from the Shura military base. Two of them, one was the chief rabbinate, a rabbi of the Israeli military, who I believe he is a colonel, he might be a general, but also his predecessor, who was, actually they're both generals, one's a lieutenant general and the other's a brigadier general. Both of them also told this story about the butchered pregnant mother. And numerous Israeli sources have completely debunked this story. This is a lie, it never happened, there's no evidence of this. And so you have two generals who are making this claim, and this person, Sherry Mendez, who's serving under them, she's also making this claim. Then five of the 12, another five are Zaka volunteers. So as I mentioned about Zaka, they're this Haredi organization, and I recommend folks read the piece I did in The Intercept. It is really one of the craziest stories you will ever read. The way I describe Zaka's role in all this, it's like Enron meets Jeffrey Epstein meets George Santos, except it's worse. Basically, the founder of Zaka had been raping children since the 1980s, and two of his brothers were involved. This was all covered up. It was well known within the Orthodox community. The police covered up, opened two investigations, and then covered them up. This all came out in 2021 when the founder, Yehuda Meshi Zahav, was supposed to be awarded this prize. That was too much for his victims. victims, basically dozens of them, one or two dozen, started speaking to the media. He tried to commit suicide. He failed, but he died a year later. He went into a coma. So on October 7th, Zaka was completely bankrupt. And what looks like happened, what appears to have happened, and a lot of this, all of this I got from Israeli media, but in particular, there was one excellent Haaretz article where they basically claimed, or they claimed outright, that Zaka turned October 7th into this giant cash grab because they were bankrupted on October 7th. But it really looks like there was this deal struck between Zaka and the Israeli government. This one Hasbara official, a volunteer consultant serving in Netanyahu's office, said, after October 7th, the entire state of Israel was focused on fixing the narrative that Hamas equals ISIS, right? Because if you can make the world believe that Hamas equals ISIS, then it's no longer a war between two combatants. It's a war between basically, you know, truth and liberty and this demonic force that the world must unite to eliminate, exterminate completely. And so that was this Hasbara official in Netanyahu's office that saying this. And then he says, the men of Zaka were amazing in convincing Western reporters what human monsters we're dealing with. And then he says, this deepened the legitimacy of the Israeli state to act with great force, right? Meanwhile, and this is a George Santos part of it, is that the Zaka officials, these guys who are appearing all over the media, right? They're in Reuters, on CNN, New York Times, AP, Politico, Washington Post. I found interviews with a number of them, including one guy, Yossi Landau, one of their senior officials. I found four different interviews where he says on camera, the bodies is telling us stories. Or he's like, when we go into the houses, we're using our imagination. The bodies is telling us stories. So they're outright admitting they are fabricating atrocity propaganda. Another senior, one of the topmost Zaka officials, Haim Utzmagin, he, in an Israeli foreign ministry video, says, and this is Israeli state propaganda, the walls screamed rape, the stones screamed rape, right? So they're outright admitting they're fabricating atrocities. So what you have are these five guys who account for a vast number of these stories are just telling the most outlandish stories. They're saying things about how, like, they find bodies of women under rubble, a body of a woman under rubble with all her organs removed. And I'm like, how does this work? How do you, first of all, how can you find something like that under rubble and all the organs removed? It sounds like something out of Jack the Ripper. Or Simcha Greineman, who he spoke at the infamous UN session on December 4th, where Israel was promoting its rape hoax to the world. He had earlier said that he had found naked women tied to trees at the Supernova Rave Festival, whose bodies had been mutilated and they had been sexually assaulted. And I'm like, how is any of that believable? There would be a huge amount of forensic evidence. There would be all this photographic and video evidence. You can actually find videos of atrocities where you can see Israeli police officials who are videoing the scene. Right. And so we're supposed to believe there's no evidence of this whatsoever, except eyewitness reports. Simcha Greineman also claimed that foreign fighters came into Israel. And how did they discover this? Because they had their IDs in their pocket. You know, that's what foreign fighters do when they invade another country. They bring their IDs along. Just in case anyone needs to check their identity, right? And it's on and on. These guys are also, they're making like all these claims about eight burnt babies on clothesline. You know, this another of these ultra-Jewish Orthodox organizations, United Hatzalah, the leader of that, he's the one who claimed that Hamas fighters put a baby in the oven. And, you know, the burnt baby stories, I think it's clear what they're meant to do. They're meant to invoke the Holocaust, right? You know, burnt babies, burnt children. That's why they keep saying that, burnt, 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 right? That this is basically ways. And this was part of the rhetoric we heard after October 7th. It's as bad as the Holocaust. This is worse than the Holocaust. You know, the most Jews killed since the Holocaust. It's all this like attempt to brand Hamas and by extension all Palestinians as Nazis, and all you can do with Nazis is exterminate them all. So, you know, like I said, in terms of the Unit 669 paramedic, he's another one. The thing was, his story was so outlandish from the beginning, because in his very first interview, which gets cited all over the place, it's with a right-wing Indian news station, because India is now extremely Islamophobic in the last 20 years under Modi's influence and the BJP. This paramedic, this military paramedic, says that they found a one-year-old baby, his team found a one-year-old baby dead in a trash can with stab wounds over its body. Again, we know that's a lie, because the one infant that was killed was 10-month Mila Cohen, who was shot in her mother's arm. And he also said that they found Arabic sentences written on the houses in the blood of their victims. And again, it's just like, this is so absurd. How can anyone believe this guy? And yet for months, his was one of the most widely cited stories, claiming he found a dead girl who had been raped because there was sperm on her back. And then a few months ago, his story was debunked. A video came out showing the girls he was talking about were fully clothed. But from the beginning, there's also other things that were clear. It was clear that he was lying. And so, you know, it's remarkable to me how much that not only Western media has fallen for it, but I think, you know, the left media has been pretty appalling with some rare exceptions.
You mentioned a number of organizations, but I think you left out Israel's Civil Commission on 7 October crimes. I mean well, that's a major player in curating the stories. So what's been their position on this, and how have they been central to perpetrating the rape hoax?
So the Israeli Civil Commission, I could never find out exactly how it was set up. Like, I felt there had to be some state support, because the woman who headed it up, Kokav Elkayim Levy, she served in Netanyahu's office as a Hasbara official, and her CV includes that she wrote a paper in the Harvard Law Review, and I read the paper, unlike many journalists, I do my work, where it's a 49-page brief trying to figure out ways to justify force-feeding Palestinian prisoners who are in hunger strike, right? Now, if you Google Kokav Elkayim Levy, you'll see all this stuff about, oh, she's this noted human rights scholar and feminist scholar and intersectional feminist, and yet her one great contribution has been trying to figure out how to justify the torture of prisoners. That's, you know, but this is Israel, right? You know, the human rights means torture. So this civil commission was given great prominence by Haaretz and other media outlets. And there was this huge piece that profile that they did of her. And they what they were supposed to be doing was collecting evidence of the October 7th attacks and documenting it. And this was going to be some sort of, you know, historic role that they played. But, you know, I read the piece again and again, because there's so many absurd things she says in this big profile of her. So it says outright that the job of the commission is to gather evidence. But then Elkayim Levy, and these are her exact words, she's outraged that she needs to offer evidence of rape. And these are her exact words. Quote, "Am I the one who needs to provide the evidence for the terrorist deeds? What kind of travesty is it that they are imposing the burden of proof on me? Now that is just mind blowing and jaw dropping, right? Her commission, its only reason for existence is to provide evidence. And she's saying, why do I have to provide any evidence? Then she says stuff like October 7th is about the most documented set of horrors that humanity has known. But then she also says evidence is completely secondary. She said she refused to cooperate with journalists, and she would tell them, quote, you are journalists, do your job, don't ask me what happened and how it happened. She says she won't, if journalists ask for numbers of sexual assaults, she says, quote, I don't cooperate. And she says, I won't participate in that game of determining the reliability of witnesses. And so what it turns out, the role that she really was playing was basically attacking, was cancel culture, was attacking UN women's groups, trying to get leading advocates like Rema Al-Salem, who advocates, I think what she does is she's the advocate for victims of sexual violence. She was basically trying to get her removed. Kokavo Kaim Levy also played a central role in, there was this basically this university official in British Columbia who, she was a director of a sexual assault center at a university in BC, and she signed a letter saying that there was, you know, no evidence of rape happening on October 7th. And for that, there was this international campaign to, that got her fired and basically destroyed her life. So the role that Kokav El-Kayyum Levy played has really been one of cancel culture. But the interesting thing now, her star has also fallen because it turns out that she was basically turned the commission into a one-woman show. She was also amplifying fake atrocities, such as the pregnant mother and fetus that had been butchered. And it looked like she was taking a playbook from Zaka, that she was trying to raise all this money for herself. So the funny thing is she's been kind of sidelined. And what's in, I think, pretty ironic. So when I mentioned the founder of Zaka, Yehuda Meshi Zahav, the award he was supposed to get was what's called the Israel Prize. It's the highest civilian honor. And as I mentioned, that was too much for his victims, all these now adults who were boys, girls, and young women who were sexually assaulted. And frankly, the evidence looks like he may have sexually assaulted hundreds of Israelis, right? So basically the founder of Zaka, that's played this like key role in the atrocity propaganda, by himself may have raped more Israelis than all the fake Israeli claims about October 7th and Hamas. But Kokav El-Kayyum Levy is now supposed to get the Israel Prize. She's been awarded that, even though now she's been in Israel itself, she's been pretty discredited for basically promoting what's now seen as propaganda and for trying to turn her role into this grab for money. I mean, the whole thing is just so incredibly sordid. And, you know, I tell other journalists that, you know, if you were to even try and make a screenplay out of October 7th rape hoaxes, you would be labeled as the worst Nazi in the world, even though it's all true.
So fascinating. I mean, I want to finish on this final question regarding the UN report. The UN, I think in June, they sent
the UN reports.
Yeah, the special representative on sexual violence in conflict, Pramila Patten. Some people have used that to say, look, this is further evidence. She has acknowledged that there was rape, and others have said, no, that's not the case. So what exactly does the UN report say, and we'll end on that?
Well, so I think the most important thing about the UN report, or there's a number of important things. First, she uses a term almost exclusively, reasonable grounds to believe. And what I did is I went and looked, and I linked to it. I looked to what the methodology is, and it turns reasonable grounds to believe is a very low level of proof. of four UN fact-finding missions. First of all, she had no investigatory power. That is up to a different commission that issued a report in June that's under Navi Pillay, and that's the International Independent Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Israel and East Jerusalem. And but between the two reports, what's interesting is neither one were able to actually do any forensic investigation. That's not Patton's field anyway. Her role is to basically amplify voices in conflict zones. And she got in big trouble when she went to Ukraine in 2022. And she put out basically this hoax that there were these rape rooms where Russian soldiers were given Viagra and were raping Ukrainian women and girls. Now, interestingly, this was the same hoax used by NATO and the West against Libya in 2011 to justify their just completely horrific war, that the repercussions that are devastated Libya today and you know, much of North Africa as well, because of the complexities of what's happened in Libya as a kind of site for a lot of smuggling of migrants, right? So Patton has this record of amplifying just absurd allegations. But if you, what's interesting is if you read her report, in instance after instance, she says things like not verified, not verified, not verified. She even says she doesn't name them, but everyone knows who they are. She says that some incidents turned out to be false, and because she says kibbutz Be'eri, everyone's able to figure out what they are. That's Yossi Landau, the Zaka official who claimed he's the one who was going around claiming first about the pregnant mother butchered and the fetus. The second one was the Unit 669 paramedic who was claiming that there was these two dead girls, one or two dead girls who had been raped and then murdered. Now, the other things, though, like buried in the report, she says there's no evidence of gang rape on Road 232. That's the road coming out of the Supernova music festival, where both, when I mentioned the only two witnesses, Sapir and Ross Cohen, both claim to have seen gang rape, and yet she is saying in the report there's no evidence of gang rape. I think there's other reasons to dismiss the story. She also says things like they reviewed all this evidence. There's no evidence of sexual mutilation. There's no evidence of targeting of sexual areas with gunfire. They said it was either her or the Pillay report says we looked at all the photos and videos and we could not find any evidence of rape and sexual assault. And presumably they had a lot more access to these videos than, you know, the public does, than I was able to locate. And so in the cases where she does say that they believed sexual assault happened, they use the reasonable grounds, which is a low evidence of proof because it's based on basically saying credible witnesses and what evidence you can gather. But the methodology document that the UN puts out for this also says that methodology depends on the conditions. And so they use these very low levels. And one of the things that's really disappointing about the Pillay report, but it also shows how absurd these, you have to read between the lines. One, she says they could not verify any evidence of rape. But her report mentions sexual violence repeatedly. But in a footnote, Pillay says sexual violence can include non-physical acts, and they define possible sexual violence as including basically a combination of the position of how bodies were found, the state of dress, and whether there were any marks of violence to the to the corpse itself. So I'll just give you one example.
There's... So can I just step in there and say, I mean, the Israeli allegation is that Hamas used rape as a weapon of war, and there was mass rape on 7 October. So, but the definition which the UN is using, they're not corroborating that. They're basically saying we have a different understanding of what sexual violence is, but that's very different to what the Israelis have said, which is massive.
Right, but then the media report, oh, they found sexual violence. And so it's both this slippery slope and this conflation, right? So even though Palay does say they were unable to verify any accounts of rape, they have all this stuff of sexual violence. But it is so absurdly circumstantial, right? And I wanted to give you this one instance because it shows. So there's this one case of, and I think it was Reuters or the AP that reconstructed this attack in one of the kibbutzes, where there was this family of four parents and two teenage boys. They were in a safe room. The safe room was on fire, and it was so hot they took off their clothes. And eventually they decided to make a run for it, and they did, and they briefly escaped, and they laid down in a ditch like a couple hundred meters away. And they were clothed only in their underwear. And so eventually, and they had their phones with them, so they're sending text messages the whole time, and they're taking pictures of themselves. But eventually, militants found them and killed them. And so there what you have, and the description was, that's where their half-naked bodies were found. So it's just like, by Palay's definition of sexual violence, they are evidence of having sexual violence committed against them, even though we know there was no sexual violence, because their bodies were almost completely undressed, they're in a prone position, and they're marks of violence. They meet all the qualifications. And this is what becomes so absurd. Unless you're in there picking apart every little piece, you don't know what's really going on.
Aaron, thank you so much. It's been fascinating talking to you. I mean, it's lasted longer than I expected, but there's so much to speak about on this. And I think if you do address the Hannibal Directive, as you said, you're working on that as well. Love to have you on Memo Conversation once more and, talk about and discuss some of the other propaganda hoax that's been peddled by Israel. So again, thank you so much, and thank our listeners for tuning in. See you for another conversation with the Middle East Monitor. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That was Nasim Ahmad talking with Arun Gupta about how rape sold a genocide. This conversation originally aired on the 17th of July, 2024. We are out of time, but I wanted to remind you, if you have yet to actually subscribe to the podcast This Week in Palestine, you need to do that immediately. This Week in Palestine is available on all major podcast platforms, so there's no reason not to subscribe on your favorite one, and have the episode delivered to your device as soon as the show drops on Tuesdays. The podcast show notes for this week we'll have multiple articles Arun Gupta referenced in his interview, as well as a link to Middle East Monitor Conversations. It takes a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Stan Robinson and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Steve Lowe and Mohammed Al-Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC, Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.